Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How would your world change if you could no longer take your brain for granted? When Ashok Rajamani was 25 years old, he seemed to have everything going for him. A highly paid career as a PR executive in New York City, an enviably chic apartment, and a wide circle of friends happy to join him for his hard-partying night and weekend adventures. Then, on the day of his brother's wedding, the unthinkable happened. A tangled cluster of malformed veins and arteries in his brain that had been there undetected since he was born gave way. The attack triggered a life-threatening hemorrhage and led to months of hospitalization, after which he had permanent damage to his eyesight and hearing, a severe form of epilepsy, and a crushing sense of isolation lessened only by the love and loyalty of his family. Ashok Rajamani tells his story in his new memoir, The Day My Brain Exploded, A True Story. Ashok, welcome to Think.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So you had been born with this condition called arteriovenous malformation, which had not been detected until that day in 2000 when you got sick. Can you explain basically what AVM is?
An AVM is a tangle of arteries and veins that live inside your brain. On occasion, it is in your spine as well, but mostly it's in the brain. And it is a birth defect. It's congenital, and it affects 1% of the population. And many people don't know they have it because it's so tiny and doesn't manifest itself unless you have severe headaches or, of course, in my case, a complete brain bleed, hemorrhage. But, it's a very unique congenital birth defect.
So your brother's wedding was later that day. You were alone in your hotel room a little before the time you were supposed to get dressed when you experienced what you describe as a pop in your head followed by temporary blindness and excruciating pain. Tell us about what that all felt like.
It felt like an atomic bomb within my head. I'd never had an experience like that. It felt literally like an explosion inside my skull, and I knew at that point that I was probably dying. Well, I felt I was going to die. So with one finger that was working, I dialed O for operator, and I said, I'm dying. And in walked later on my brother, and I'm sure my sister-in-law was changing into her wedding dress because they were just about to get married. And they took me to the hospital next door, and luckily there was one. And that's when they discovered that my AVM had exploded.
Yeah. So talk about the memories that you have of the hospitalization that followed and what you've had to piece together from other people's accounts of all that time.
Well, it was basically unconsciousness meets consciousness, and it was severe pain. And basically, there was a lot of pain involved because I was under restraints and my head was throbbing. I had a thing called ventriculostomies, which were tubes drilled into my skull for drainage of the blood. Basically, I was in and out, and what happens is when you have brain injury is you lose your superego. There is no filter system. So you say anything. You yell out your hallucinations. You forget where you're at. So one time I forgot that I was in the hospital, and I went to stand up and go to a bathroom. I didn't realize what had happened to me, and I fell down. Every single PICC line and needle inside my body fell out. That itself was another possible death. But overall, there was just feelings of pain. My brother and my mother had been there with me, and the doctors had said, keep talking to him, because otherwise he'll slip away. So they kept talking, and my brother kept... he sang the theme song for Good Times over and over again, and it was good for me. So I sang that. He sang a lot of theme songs for different comedies, and luckily also I have a very big mouth, so I was able to keep blabbering away and keep talking, and that's pretty much what saved me.
What sort of life had you been living in New York before you got sick?
Well, like you said, it was a pretty fast-living world that I was in. It was very much based on entertainment, alcohol, fashion, glamour, pretty much what you would expect from a New York publicist kind of lifestyle. It was very fast-paced. I had traveled. It was a sort of life that I think at this point now is rather vapid and materially based. So basically, it was extremely... fast-paced, and there was a lot of addiction, a lot of alcoholism, and all of that stuff that completely was destroyed with the AVM.
What's really interesting, Ashok, is that you'd sort of stayed away from much drinking and any drugs at all up until the time you were sort of legally allowed to do those things.
Yes. Well, I'm a nerd, and I'm proud of it. I'm a proud geek, and I'm glad I was magna cum laude. I was 0.1% away from being summa, so that still irritates me. But, yeah, I'm a total geek, and I said, no, I'm not going to do anything until I'm 21. I'm glad you noticed that part. And that's when I started. And I never dealt with peer pressure. I decided to do it on my own. And basically that's what happened. I was in a sort of situation where I didn't like the profession I was in, and I didn't like where my life was heading at that point.
You know, some of it's really interesting, and it makes a kind of sense. You write also here a lot about your childhood before you ever got sick, and you give us some context on your family. It sounds in some ways like New York was your way of running away from growing up in a place where you never felt like you belonged.
Well, I often find New York is the land of refugees. Mm-hmm. From all over the world, wherever, and especially the Midwest. People run away to New York as quick as they could. But yes, it was an escape, definitely. And as soon as I could, I ran away to New York like many other people, transplants in the city.
I mean, you are you 35 now, 36?
No, I'm 38.
38, okay.
Sadness.
All right, mid-30s, we'll say mid to late 30s. But anyway, you were growing up in a time where people might not assume that the degree of racism you experienced for being the only Indian-American kid, like, in your class, it was pretty harsh in the place that you lived.
Well, I mean, even now people don't really think about that. They think any race issues are predominantly dealt with or bigotry by Latinos and African Americans. And the Indian American situation in this country is rarely addressed, which is why I'm very happy to really go forward with that, to make it a lot race-based in my book, because you don't really discuss that or deal with it. My experience was filled with bullying and bigotry and racism, both to my... Well, all of it, to my skin color, to my ethnicity, to my religion, to pretty much everything. So it was a very painful situation. And Indian Americans, it's rarely discussed among them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really happy that I brought it out. And in my acknowledgments, I give it up to little Indian American boys and girls stuck in the Midwest and letting them know they can get through it.
Why do you think it's rarely discussed in the Indian American community? Is that people don't want to acknowledge that this is a hardship?
Oh, absolutely. I think that it's pretty much Asian American altogether, South Asian or East Asian. It's this concept that it doesn't really affect them. Nobody really discusses it. And I think they think by not discussing it, it doesn't exist. But it exists tremendously.
You share a story in the book that is, it's very poignant. It's also a little bit funny. Your mother had given you this little statue of Lord Krishna, and you took it to school for show and tell. Can you talk about what happened that day?
Well, I didn't really realize what it was that much, what it was all about. All I knew that was the idol had many, many multiple arms, like many icons in Hinduism, and I'd gone there, and it was show and tell, and I had discussed him, and I said, this is God, to a certain degree, and everyone started yelling, and they said, Jesus is God, Jesus is God, and I said, my God will beat up your God, because my God has multiple hands and arms, and your Jesus only has two arms, mm-hmm. So he's going to beat you up and beat up your Jesus. And then it was just warfare, a complete religious warfare at that point, until our first grade teacher broke us up, and that's it.
What did it take for you to find, as you got into high school, at least a sort of tribe of other kids who felt they didn't fit in either according to their race or how they dressed or the art that they were into, and how did that change things for you?
Well, fascinatingly enough, I don't think children are born racist, and I don't think even elementary school kids are racist. It's more a question of observation and finding things that are different. By the time you're 13 and 12 is when pure bullying and hate and racism begins. So when high school was a nightmare. But yes, I did find a group of other misfits, which, like I said, I was a geek, so there were tons of geeks and nerds, and I'm also an artist and a writer, and of course a minority. So we were able to form a little functioning little factory like Andy Warhol's, and we were able to get through it together. But it was very difficult. It was really, really hard. Unless you're, you know, blonde, blue-eyed, and white, it was hard. But we made it through.
So college was really good for you, and grad school not so much. Why is that?
Well, I hate to say this out loud to people, but Columbia is not the greatest in terms of individualism and personality. I hate to say it. NYU was a lot more about that. It was a lot more about nonconformity and talking to teachers that were interesting and interested in you. And when I had gone to, and basically everyone said Columbia is such a big deal. When I had gone there, I was really shocked with the amount of conformity and the amount of, you have to be very quiet and you really can't speak your mind about different things. At least my experience was that. And and at the same time, I had not realized what it is I wanted to do with my life. I had graduated in PhD and journalism, and at a certain point I thought maybe I'd go into South Asian studies or philosophy or something. I get to Columbia and I realize I want fashion and glamour.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I left that and became a publicist.
When you were sick, you had a lot of experiences where you felt the presence of the divine. You felt that you were divine. Can you talk a little bit about how all of that manifested itself for you, and how your memories now, how clear they are of that time?
Well, I was born and raised a Hindu. So a lot of that was in my head, the concept of karma and the concept of your spirituality far exceeds your physicality.
Mm-hmm.
So, and also there's a concept of the sword versus the flutes, the sword being aggression and a sort of violence, not violence, but strength of character, and then the flute being about surrender. And I basically vacillated between surrender and fighting. And those two elements are what saved me in a way. It should save a lot of people is to surrender, but at the same time, you can't give up. You have to be strong. One of my hallucinations, however, involved me swimming in a sort of canal like a fish, and I thought I was in God's womb. So I started screaming when I was done. I said, I was in her womb. I was in God's womb. And, of course, they thought, you know, I was a crazy brain-injured person, but that has lived on with me, the concept that God is beyond gender, and if anything, God is feminine. But the idea that there is something bigger and larger than anything we could possibly know, that has remained within me.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. If you look back on that time now, I mean, you recognize that your brain was very ill, that you were very ill. But I wonder if you think there was something valid in your sense of the divine in those moments in particular.
I think something, it wasn't just something, I think it was totally valid. I think it was I had already been spiritual, I was already spiritual before this, but it basically became stronger. My faith in something higher propelled me into a sort of peace and a freedom in terms of where I was headed. I never really doubted that something was going to happen. And the beauty of an AVM or any birth defect, there is a certain sense of eventualism or mm-hmm. eventuality where you know you were born this way. This was not, you know, a lot of brain injury is based on being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right.
A car hits you, you fall into, you know, traffic or something like that. I was born with this. And at that time, when you realize it, you do believe in karma. And there was a reason that I did survive this, and I survived it with functionality, with my motor skills intact.
My guest is author Ashok Rajamani. His new memoir is called The Day My Brain Exploded, A True Story. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Ashok Rajamani. His new memoir is called The Day My Brain Exploded, A True Story. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Ashok, while you were in the hospital, you developed meningitis. You had to be sort of out of the woods with that before doctors could operate on the AVM. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And then very soon after that, they were telling you, okay, time to get up and start walking, which suddenly sounded like a really terrifying prospect.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Correct.
So talk a little bit about that, because on the one hand, we can understand having not done it in a while, but were you afraid that you would fall? Were you afraid that somehow your body wouldn't work properly?
Oh, I was mortified. By the whole process and the premise of getting out of that bed,
yeah.
At that point, it had become so indicative of safety. It was something that was a safety net, and the concept of just getting up and walking. So even to walk to a chair, I remember there was a disciplinarian nurse who said, "Get up," and he started abusing me. And it sort of worked by yelling at me, and I got up. By the time I got up, moved into a chair, I didn't think I could go any further. They said, "You can get up and walk." I said, "How can I do that?" And they had a little cane, and they said, "There is your mother," and she was at the end of a long hallway. And they said, "Walk to your mother, and you can make it, and you could start walking." And I was petrified, but like a 2-year-old toddler or 1-year-old, I walked, and my mother was rooting for me. And I was so slow, and I was like a little baby, but I made it, and I will always love her for that. By the time I reached, she hugged, and I knew I could walk then.
You know, it's fascinating because none of us remembers learning to walk, and it must have been an exhilarating thing. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, to have to go through that when you're 25, I think you do a great job here of conveying, you know, you're making strides and yet, you know, having to go back to relying on your parents, on your brother, was a hard thing to accept after you'd had a measure of independence and, in fact, success.
Yeah, I felt rather humiliated in many aspects. To become childlike after that, after living on your own and having independence. But in a way, I grew to understanding that it was okay to be helped, but that didn't really stop the humiliation of being, say, bathed or, you know, being taught how to walk again. But I kind of understood that this was a necessity for me to get to where I had to get, but still it was a bit humiliating, yeah.
Your mom got through the time that you were drifting in and out of consciousness in part by writing letters alternately to you and to God. Can you talk about the first time you saw those letters, I guess, after you had recovered, right?
Mm-hmm. I became very emotional. I couldn't really believe that she had done that, and she said that was her way to deal with it. Now, I myself was wondering how would a mother sit there and watch her child be, you know, such pain, hurting, and everything like that. Then, you know, eventually I remembered the Bible, I saw the movie The Passion of the Christ, and I saw Mother Mary standing watching her son being crucified. And I remember thinking, why would that happen? And it dawned on me that mothers can't leave their kids no matter what pain, no matter, you know, what was going through it. So that what she wrote was the way, her coping mechanism of dealing with that. She didn't want to leave me physically, but at the same time, she needed to sort of vent whatever sorrow she had.
We have an email here to think@kera.org from John in Dallas, who wants to know, in what part of your brain was the malformation located, and what difference has it made to you to understand your own brain a bit better?
It happened at the right temporal parietal occipital lobe. So it affected my emotional memory, my behavior, and my visual field, which in my book I deal with the idea that I have become now partially blind.
Mm-hmm.
I've become half blind in both eyes permanently, which has been very difficult, and that has been very difficult to intellectual. You can intellectually understand that you're half blind, but when you walk, there is no demarcation, so it looks like I'm seeing the world, but I'm not.
Yeah.
So I can get hit. I can fall down. I hate to say a U-Haul truck hit me because I wasn't looking. My head has to be like an oscillating fan. It has to go back and forth in order to see my surroundings. So basically, it's been very odd to know the consequences of what happened to my brain. The temporal lobe, a lot of it is about emotion and parietal as well, which affects my behavioral patterns of how I contend with people. So in a way, it's a mix of involuntary problems that happen from my brain and voluntary ways that I'm dealing with what happened to my brain. And both of them are very difficult.
So, Ashok, talk about the emotional memory, because this was something I was interested to read. You wrote that you would, for example, see photographs, mm-hmm. and then you would realize, okay, now I can remember this thing that happened, but you couldn't attach any feeling whatsoever to, you know, pictures of happy moments and things that had made you laugh in the past. What was that like, and did you know right away that you weren't experiencing emotions?
It was really, really devastating because I had friends take me on a tour from my past, like a soap opera amnesia kind of thing, and they showed me my college, and I kept thinking, wow, it must have been scary coming from the Midwest all the way to the big city. Mm. And I knew those words, that it's scary, but I myself didn't feel that sort of, I didn't evoke a sort of fright within myself. Like, for instance, a woman remembering giving birth, she knows the date and time she gave birth, but she can also feel that emotion of giving birth. She can remember that emotion, and it's a beautiful thing. However, that's very difficult for me, and in fact, I can meet distant relatives. I can know who they are, but my emotional attachment to them, it's hard to recover, and it's hard to access.
That's got to be tough on relationships.
Yeah, it's tough all over the place. It's tough with relationships, with people that I know, with people that I love, and with spaces, with scenes that I know, parts of my life. It's very difficult. It's not 100% of the time, but it's enough of a time to hurt me, to make me sad, to make me think, wow, that part of me is gone.
Mm-hmm. You write about having friends who, some of whom were sort of there while you were in the hospital, and then things changed once you were out. And I wonder if you think that was, you know, sort of a flaw on their part? Was it a factor of being, you know, also 25 and just not having the emotional capacity to help you cope with this from start to finish? Have you come to terms with what happened there?
Well, I don't think it's my case alone. I think a lot of people have friends or people in their family who are tragedy queens, as I call them, who are in your life. The minute you have tragedy and sorrow, they want to be there and they want to be Joan of Arc, and they want to help you, and the minute you start healing and the minute you're doing fine, they find it not as interesting because there's no one they can really, you know, be on stage with and then realize, oh, look, I'm dealing with such pain, I'm helping my friend out. And the moment you start getting better, those same people that were into the tragedy kind of left. I know, besides my friends, an aunt or a relative like that also behaved like that. During the time, it was, oh, Ashok. The minute I got better, you know, then there's no excitement to that pain.
I mean, can you muster the emotions to even get upset about that, or do you just have to let it go at some point?
Oh, it's taken a lot of time to deal with it. It still hurts a lot of the time. I would think that people would stay with you the minute you get better or when you are getting better, but there's a lot of people that get sort of, not joy, but they can get feel important by having a sick person in their life that they can take care of. And like I said, that is not just my case. Unfortunately, for a lot of people, they have people in their lives that are with them during the tragic moments and then leave when they get better.
I love the way that you portray your nuclear family here, your brother and his wife and your mom and dad. And they don't come across as perfect or saints, but they are people who were sort of doing their best. And you write about an incident where you and your brother had a disagreement and sort of hung up the phone with each other and then called back and apologized. But because your brain was working less well then, you didn't remember the makeup and you stayed mad through multiple phone calls. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's this short-term erratic amnesia that does happen for a lot of people, that I can find closure, I can say there's a fight, I can resolve everything. The next morning, my anger towards that fight will be fresh. Mm-hmm. And I will tell, you know, I'll yell at my brother, how could you do this? And he would just, you know, call me a bad word or something and just say I'm nuts. But it's not, again, it's with anybody, really. I fight with someone, I get angry with someone, I think everything is resolved. The next morning, that freshness, it feels like I was just hurt that morning. And it usually takes a few days for me to accept that it has been, that I have faced closure with it. But it's very difficult for me, too. And I think that the people who associate with me have to be extraordinarily patient. And the people that are in my life, I give them kudos, because to be with a brain-damaged person is very difficult.
Why did it take you 4 years to seek out a support group for other people, for people with traumatic brain injury?
Because I did not want to believe that I'd been handicapped in any way. Hmm. I did not want to believe I was disabled. And the most interesting thing of brain injury for a lot of people is it's considered the invisible condition, where you look perfectly fine on the outside and you don't, it's the inside that's damaged. I like to think of it as like a Christmas gift, right, that's beautifully packaged. On the inside, though, it's a broken toy.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know that. So I waited 4 years because I refused to believe it. I would look in the mirror and say, oh, look, there's Ashok. Nothing happened to him. But deep down, things were going on in my life that I realized few people could understand, and few people were helping me go through this. And so I was able to, after 4 years, enter a support group system, which itself led itself to a lot of terror in a way, because a lot of people have visual results of what happened to them. They were in wheelchairs, or quadriplegic, or blind, or things like that. And meanwhile, I'm completely intact physically. So, but at the same time, after 4 years, it was great to meet other people in the same boat that could deal with how they a different world, a different universe, which I've had as well.
Did it drive home for you the fact that, and please, if this sounds insensitive, I don't mean it to be, but as things could have gone, you were luckier than other people who've been in your situation?
Yes, but it's really, I don't know how I feel about it, because of course I'm blessed to be in this condition, but you also get a lot more, I hate to say the word, but say abuse. For instance, nobody could tell my blindness, or they couldn't see how my brain works, and they'll kind of forget about that. They might make a quick turn while we walk down, and I'll hit something. Whereas, say, I'm an amputee, and you could visually see that I don't have a limb, people would be a lot more sensitive to that respect, which is kind of ridiculous, because who would want to be in that situation? But we are a visual society, and unless you see a disability, it's going to be hard for you to contend with that person. So because I look a certain way, people do forget.
Yeah. The other thing about this injury is that for you, the long-term consequences sort of made themselves known little by little. It wasn't like the day after you got sick that you knew everything that you were going to have to deal with.
Absolutely. It was at a certain point I felt really good because the pain had disappeared to a certain degree. I was trying to, my memory was getting better. And then bam, 3 years or 2 years later, I'm walking down the street with my friend and I seize. I have a grand mal seizure of the worst kind, a tonic-clonic, where I had become crab-like.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a sort of seizure where you become like a seafood crab dish and then you fall on the floor and you shake and then it's mortifying. I had no clue I was going to have epilepsy. And then the beauty of that is the doctors are afraid of telling you that you're going to it's going to be a lifelong condition. So they'll tell you, oh, it's going to be for 2 weeks, you're on medicine. As the days go on, as the weeks go on, you realize, wait, it's permanent for the rest of your life. And you didn't know that. As soon as that was, now with epilepsy, it's very difficult to control because the medicine is trial and error. It's a cocktail of drugs, right? You can do 200 milligrams of one milligrams of another. But it's trial and error. If you do have one, that doesn't work. If you don't have one, it works. So basically, as soon as I was able to find the drug, as you'd see in my book, I thought I was scot-free, and then I had hallucinations and was diagnosed as psychotic, and that happened much later. So it seemed like nothing would ever end. Yeah, just keep going.
Do you think the psychosis diagnosis was correct, or was it maybe related to the epilepsy and not the same as psychosis in another context?
Well, nobody could really fathom what was going on with that. We tried to do testing to see if it was seizures, and it wasn't, because I was able to, in a weird way, control it and not control it simultaneously. I had to look up online that there is something called AIWS, Alice in Wonderland Syndrome, which looked like what I was having, which was a distorted world. Things were up and down and small and little, and that's because Lewis Carroll supposedly had that. But at the same time, nobody really knew. One neuro-ophthalmologist called it metamorphosia, which I could understand that that might be a term as well. But nobody really understood what was going on. So that was very difficult, and I did have to go to a therapist at one point who thought I might be psychotic until he realized psychotics believe their hallucinations are real.
Mm-hmm.
Non-psychotics will know that they're having hallucinations, so they realized I'm not.
Yeah, it's funny. We just had Oliver Sacks on the show, and I don't know if you've read his latest book, but it's all about hallucinations and how much more common they are among people who are mentally sane than many people mm-hmm. realize.
Oh, yeah, I could imagine. Either way, it's a very frightening situation.
Yeah. Have you made close friendships with people that you have met through or that you did meet through the support group that you attended?
I have, and it's really exciting because, like I said, we have no superego, so we can be, as they'd say, inappropriate and ill-mannered in social events.
Yeah.
And it's really nice to be with others that are like that. In a way, we're trying, of course, to be, you know, well-behaved, but sometimes it's difficult. But yeah, I formed really great friendships. In fact, I formed writing groups with brain injured people, and it's interesting the way we write. We write a lot of things about our past, things about brain injury, and it was their support that's helping me go on.
My guest is author Ashok Rajamani. His new memoir is called The Day My Brain Exploded, A True Story. We'll come back to our discussion in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Ashok Rajamani, author of The Day My Brain Exploded, A True Story. You can join us on the Think page of KERA.org by sending email to think@KERA.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. We had this comment posted to our page. It says, this is from Kay, who writes, Ashok, I'm eager to read The Day My Brain Exploded. I volunteer at the VA hospital in Dallas and teach computer skills and creative writing in the Veteran Recovery Center. Several of my students are living with brain trauma, and she says, good luck with your journey on the right, WRITE, track. So nice to hear from Kay. I wonder what you wish that more people understood about traumatic brain injury that still, even after we've been made more aware of these conditions because of our military engagement, doesn't seem to enter the public consciousness.
I would like people to just pay attention that it is a condition that exists.
Mm-hmm.
And unless it's a Hillary Clinton or a vet or, you know, someone famous that has it, nobody really talks about it and nobody understands it. And it needs to be talked about. There needs to be more research and funding, which there isn't. And it has to be, I want people to realize that this is a lifelong thing. This is not breaking your arm or breaking your leg. It's something that stays with you forever. So if you know someone brain injured or if you are brain injured, the number one thing you can show people or you can have for yourself is patience and love and realizing that the brain has been affected and the brain is the control center of your body. So when that is affected, you are affected in such a, you know, extreme way. So the number one thing also is for loved ones, friends, teachers, everyone to know how severe this condition is. No matter how fantastic the person looks, it's a severe, severe condition.
What did it take for you, and I ask about this, as you know, because you mentioned it in the book, but you know, part of recovering from any illness is sort of feeling like an entire person again, including, you know, sexuality. And I guess you came to a point where you realized you hadn't even thought one way or another about sex for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we never got to discuss how the hemorrhage actually happened. Am I allowed to?
You can if you're just really careful with the language, absolutely.
Basically what did it was a form of a self-love. Mm-hmm. And upon my return from the hospital, upon my return from all of that, I was frightened to death about anything sexual, because that's what started my hemorrhage. And that's when I found out for a lot of people, brain injury is urogenitally based. So people get it when they use the bathroom, when they do sexual relations for themselves or with someone else, or giving birth. So all of these things frighten me to such a degree, and now I can say I still have anxieties sexually, but I'm hoping they will get better as the days move on. But it's that concept of I can never go back to D.C. itself as well. It's my Auschwitz.
Wow.
That's where it happened. So people associate tragic things with tragic things, and they don't want to revisit that.
You haven't had, like, even a desire to drink alcohol again. What do you think accounts for that?
That lobe had been destroyed.
Huh.
And like I say, God bless everyone who are 12-steppers who are able to do this. I could only do it by having a brain hemorrhage. I don't know how they do it, but addiction is such a strong, strong, strong situation that... Yeah, my brain had to be destroyed in a certain way for me to give that up.
I'm always interested, speaking with anyone who writes a memoir, whether or not they have, you know, struggled with brain injury, about, you know, the way that memory works and what you can remember. I wonder if this was especially at the top of your mind as you were writing, that you were recalling all these events with a brain that sometimes you could fully trust and sometimes you couldn't.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I had other people to, give me that thumbs up to say, yeah, that's exactly what happened. Because no matter what, it's an unfortunate ailment that you do kind of exist in a world of doubt. I call myself a shok, too, because the shok one died. And I will continually have a sort of low self-image in that I doubt myself. I don't think that I'm as intelligent as I used to be, regardless of what people say. And I find that out for a lot of brain-injured people, that they do doubt themselves to such a degree. They do doubt their feelings. They don't understand things, or they don't seem to realize that things aren't as bad as they think it is. So... It was difficult in a way to write this book without having a lot of doubt, correct? But then I did it correctly and honestly.
Do you like Ashok 2 now as much as you liked Ashok 1?
Yeah, it's kind of like having two children. They're two different, personalities, but you love both of them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happier in a way that Ashok 1, with his fast-paced world, he really put more emphasis on the material versus the spiritual. And I'm happy that Ashok 2 is the opposite, and Ashok 2 kind of understands what is important versus what's not important, that money is less important than humanity.
So you returned initially to work at the place. It's kind of an amazing story, because you'd only been working for a week at your mm-hmm. new job, and there was a COBRA issue that luckily was straightened out. But talk a little bit about your return to work in PR and finally, ultimately, your decision that you needed to do something different.
Well, I mean, one of the first issues is that I didn't realize that I was half blind. So I would yell and I would get angry if, a form wasn't right, a status thing wasn't right. At that point, I also realized that what PR didn't really work for me at that point, because I wasn't as interested in that world as I used to be. And because my superego had vanished too, I think I was a little more ill-mannered than one should be with clients or in business office situations. But mostly I realized this is not what I wanted to do anymore, so I had to get out.
Talk about the kind of art that you do now in addition to writing.
Well, it's actually less art than I used to do because I don't have a studio space and I'm really, really messy. But I can, and now it's changed from big canvases and big paintings to smaller pieces, to smaller media, basically. Mm-hmm. I use smaller canvases, I use smaller paper, everything is different. And because of my blindness, my half-blindness, I was so terrified because I'm a figurative artist in that I don't do abstract art. I do figures. Mm-hmm. So I was freaked out that I didn't have the symmetry, but then, you know, people had to tell me, look at Picasso, look at all different artists. They take different, you know, worlds and they go different angles. So if your left side, my left side is blind now, and if I'm doing a portrait and the left side is completely screwed up, I'm now realizing that that's perfectly fine and where I'm at right now.
It is the way you see the world, literally.
And also, I'm inspired by Chuck Close because he has had a lot of neurological issues, but he's able to do such beautiful portraiture through color and through everything. And he's been an inspiration. So I look through a lot of artists to inspire me, too, also just simply Frida. It didn't affect her neurology as much as just her own mental makeup, her spinal condition, I feel, was so destructive to her, but she continued to paint and she continued not only to obsess about it but to triumph about her pain of what happened. A lot of my artwork now is based on my brain as to what happened.
How did you begin to really embrace activism for traumatic brain injury? I guess it was a step in the process. First, you really had to, as you mentioned, you know, accept that you had been disabled and then incorporate that into your identity.
Yeah, I mean, it was more of a question of going to support groups and seeing how badly people are understanding what happened or how badly people understand what others are going through. And one of the big things I've had to explain to people is that the person before a brain injury is dead. You cannot keep hoping that that person will come back because that person is dead. This new person is going to have a lot of who that old person is. And, of course, there are certain baseline personality traits, but he's a new person. And when you realize that, you basically are a lot calmer. In things that you thought you weren't able to do, you now realize, hey, I can do it. Hmm. I wasn't able to say a certain word, now I can say it. Things like this, little triumphs in the old world might have been little triumphs, but for this one, it's a huge triumph. With all of this, I'm realizing that I want to help others. With my epilepsy, it devastates me when I think of little children or people that cannot articulate what they're going through because seizures are the worst you can possibly deal with. So I'm very pleased that I'm able to document and articulate and represent what this is all about, what I'm going through. So part of my, responsibility or what I find to be responsibility is the fact that I can document, I can articulate what we go through. And this is very important, and that's part of activism to a certain degree, to do, to help others deal with what they can't deal with.
When you have any sort of warning that a seizure might be coming, your instinct is to run.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's very strange, the fear of death. And it's like your body knows. There's a thing called an aura before a seizure. And an aura is the smell of burning rubber and metal and something horrible. So say I'm walking down the street and I'm walking by a restaurant throwing out bad food, garbage. I look at it and I say, oh, my God, is an aura coming? Mm. So there is that fear. And also there's that fear of thinking, if I run fast enough, I can defeat death. I can run away from death. I try to run to my house. I'll try to run thinking that I can defeat death. But, of course, it's within you. The electricity, the seizure is with it. You can't run away from it. But in my head, I want to run away from it. And I realized that was another thing that I've realized is that I used to think to myself that if something was so horrible, this just be, you know, you'd be like, okay, let me die. That's not the case at all. You want to survive with the last bit of energy. You want to survive. In philosophy class, we learned there was a joke saying, who would want to turn 100 years old? And the answer is the man that's 99.
Yeah.
So it's the, and I didn't believe it, but there's something so true to that. We want to survive. We have an instinct to survive, and no matter what, you can be suicidal, you can be depressed. I mean, there are these things called suicidal gestures, right, where they think they're going to do suicide, but at the last minute they don't want it.
Mm-hmm.
This was a big learning lesson. So when I do have a seizure, I will run, because I think I'm running from death, but I mean I'm not.
One more sweet story that you tell in the book is, actually, initially it seemed like it wouldn't turn out well, but you met a mother and her son in the grocery store, and you asked the mother, seeing the scar on the little boy's head, if he had had a brain surgery.
Yeah, I saw this little boy. He had, his back was scarred, and I knew something was going on, and I think he had a brain surgery. And I was impressed, first of all, that this woman is going to talk to some stranger in New York City. That was very impressive to me. I asked her, you know, what happened to the son, and then she was so honest. It also showed to me a lot of people want to be honest about their grief because they're not able to talk about it to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And she just said, yes, my son had what's called an AVM, and it's a horrible, monstrous thing. I told her I had that, and she didn't believe it because looking at me, she couldn't believe it. I told her I did have it, and not to give up. Be patient. He's going to make it. The kid's name was Kevin, and I said, don't give up. Feel good that this will get better. It will get better.
Are you already hearing, Ashok, from people who have had similar injuries and have read the book and have been touched by it?
Actually, I am, and it's really it's wonderful. It's really wonderful to see. It's a book that I think needs to have been written. I think that we need far more books on brain injury because it is such a common issue that's not being discussed.
Mm-hmm. So I guess at this point you definitely feel like it was worth the emotional risk that you took in putting all this out there for everyone to read.
And the physical risk, because yeah. I can't see half the world, so it was very difficult to look at the computer monitor. So that itself was difficult. And yes, to be 100% honest about your life is very difficult. I think all memoirists are brave. And I now realize it's the truth, but it's worth it. It was worth to be this honest and to document what happened to me if it's going to help others.
We should say you also have a website. You blog, is that right?
Yes, and my website also gives information on brain injury and a bunch of links and about vision, too. It's ashokrajamani.com, ashokrajamani.com, and it gives all the information that you could get from the Brain Injury Association to a blog to everything.
Great. We will put a link to that on our website as well. The new memoir by Ashok Rajamani is called The Day My Brain Exploded, A True Story. Ashok, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast for free at kera.org/think. And of course, we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.